Good afternoon. So I'm going to do exam review, which means I will take a bunch of questions from you or things you want me to talk about. And once I think I've gotten a reasonably complete list, I'll start going through them in some order that hopefully has related topics kind of stay together. So thanks. Yes. Okay. The quiz due today, and I noticed that the second one was miskeyed, because I apparently can't count zeros. So quiz today, Q1 and 2. Okay. Other...
Why, how it works,
why use, how it works, okay. Yeah. So, like, how much fits in an inode, how much an inode can point to, and so on? Anything else I should talk about? A second round. Okay, so I'll start do this in roughly, we'll do mmap first, then the two file system questions, then the quiz today. Okay, so mmap. So first, why would you use mmap? So one thing is it's a convenient way to load files into memory and have the OS handle the details. So for example, my reference solution for the fat read assignment uses mmap to load the disk image rather than seeking and reading all the time, because I found it more convenient to use pointer arithmetic to figure out where I was in the image than otherwise. Another example is, like, typically loading programs is effectively a bunch of mmap calls. So you want to load a program, you need to load the code into memory, and the OS, like, kind of needs this as core functionality because it needs to make exec work. This is sort of the functionality that's really handy for implementing that. And this also means that you load code with one set of, with, you know, read-only, load initial values of global, copy on write, and that gives you a use case. Why does mmap support this copy on write private mapping? Well, one reason is that this is exactly how you load a program. If you have some initial values of global variables, you load that copy on write, and that just takes care of it. So it was a convenient choice for that. It's not the only thing you could have done. One thing. So as for how it works, mmap works. So most importantly, in the process control block contains a list of mmap regions, you know, e.g. addresses through 5,000, you know, come from foo.exe bytes, you know, 4096 and on. So, like, that's in the process control block. And on a page fault, the OS can look up the mmap region and use that. So in this case, you know, if page fault at 0x4000, then, you know, load the page containing, you know, load the page that contains bytes 4096 through food.exe. And when we say load, what we really mean is, you know, mmap, you know, pages that are mmap can be shared with the page cache. So the OS is already caching file data. And one thing we could do is we could say, oh, you had a page fault, you need to load that file. You know, I'm going to make a copy of that now. But instead, no. So don't copy when loading for mmap. Just make the PTE point to the page, to the cache copy, and make sure the cache copy doesn't go away. So they need to do some reference counting so they know, oh, you're actually using this. I better not uncache it from under you. Or if I do, I better like at least mark your page table entry as invalid. But this is like, so this is the, so another part of the savings that you couldn't get by implementing this sort of loading yourself is that you're now sharing, you know, saving space maybe. And this also means mmap can be used to share memory between programs. So that's just a feature that they support, and they support it because it's kind of free. If you're already making the loading faster by just giving a pointer to the cache copy rather than copying the cache copy, then making it so two processes have a pointer to the same thing is the easier feature to implement than ensuring that they don't. So anything I'm missing there or that's unclear or incomplete? So then we had how much inodes point to, so figuring out how much an inode points to. So remember the, you know, big idea, inode is all the file data in one place. That all you need to do anything you care to do with the file is know its inode. You can read the file, you can check its permissions, you can check its size, you can write the file, and so on, but just having a pointer to the inode, which typically takes the form of there's an array of inodes, it's this element of the array. And, you know, but since inode is fixed size, need a way to store large and small files. So unlike the fat, we want something kind of like a linked list here, you know, like the fat, but we're not going to use the same sort of big array for every block on disk, which gives us a static allocation. So we're going to need to, you know, so want to allocate variable amounts of space to file. And the solution is that, you know, part of the data about where a file is in the inode. So we're going to store part of that data there. And these are what we called the, and this included, you know, the direct pointers, most notably. Part of the data, if the file is too big, needs to go elsewhere. Because we can't just make the inode bigger, it has a fixed size, it's in that array, we can't allocate more space to it directly, so we need to do it indirectly. So, you know, and inode contains pointers to this, you know, data about where a file is. It needs to go elsewhere, pointers to this extra metadata. So we have this data about where the file is, that the direct pointers, that this is where the main part of the file is, and we have more data about where the file is because sometimes we ran out of space. So we need those pointers, and these are the indirect, the, you know, possibly, what, the, you know, indirect pointers are the solution we've usually seen for that. So the direct pointers are just, you know, just what blocks is the file data in. So if you think about your FAT project, basically the, you know, for a single cluster file, we had a direct pointer to where the data was in the directory entry, and the same idea for the inode, but instead of having one, we have one for the first several blocks of the file. So fixed number stored in inode for the first several blocks of the file. So this is how you figure out where block 0, 1, 2 for some small number of the file is. And the intuition here is that, you know, for most files are small, so this is all most files need. You know, that when we looked at how people empirically use disks, just that most of the files we're only going to have in direct pointers, so the inode is going to be all we need. And we'll just have enough of them, of common numbers like 10, and that will handle most of our files, but some of our files are going to need more. So then we had, so then, if direct pointers in the inode aren't enough, we need more of them. So the solution is allocate more blocks of direct pointers. So we're just going to allocate a whole block of direct pointers, which will typically be way more than we would put in direct pointers than we put in the inode. And why a block? Why a block? Because we don't allocate smaller units on our disk. Not because it's the right size otherwise, but just because that's the unit in which we can allocate space on our disk. So indirect pointer is, you know, points to a block of direct pointers. And then we have the issue of, well, what if we use our indirect pointer and we have our block of direct pointers and then we still ran out of space? We could just add more indirect pointers, but that's not going to scale very well, because what we want to happen is we want to support 1 to 100 KB files well, but also handle like very big files well. So if we just had enough indirect pointers to handle a gigabyte file, that still would be very bad. So we're going to use more indirection. So we'll have, you know, a double indirect pointer as a way of doing that. So the idea is, well, we couldn't fit enough indirect pointers, so allocate a whole block of them. And each of those indirect pointers can have a whole block of direct pointers they point to. And this gives us a lot more space. And, well, it turns out when we do the math for common file system sizes, for the really big files we want to support, like the multi-gigabyte, like movie files or backups of my entire hard drive for my VM, that still isn't enough, so we might have a triple indirect pointer, which is the same idea, but with yet another layer. And we get the result is a tree structure, sort of not like a straight tree, but a tree-like structure, where it gets sort of bushier the further into the file we get. Because our rule here is that the, you know, first blocks, the next set of blocks are used the an indirect pointer, then following that. So then in order, we use the more and more indirection. And the intuition behind that is that the bigger our file, the less we're going to care about having more places to check to figure out how to read the file. That for small files, we really care that we don't like read 17 things on the disk to read that file, but for a multi-gigabyte file, we're hardly going to notice.
So that's sort of the structure. So as for, you know, so how much space? Well, for direct pointers, we just say each points to one block. So it's, you know, number of direct pointers times our block size. For indirect pointers, each points to one block of direct pointers. So we say, so effectively with indirect pointers, we have, so this is the space, you know, that can be pointed to. So we have the number of indirect pointers times the number of direct pointers per block times the block size. Space that can be pointed to. And that's because each indirect pointer points to one block, and each block has that many direct, you know, can fit that many direct pointers. In the end, we're just doing the, and we're doing the formula from up above. So this quantity is the effective, you know, is the indirect pointers are equivalent to this many direct pointers. So we also have another thing we start getting concerned about when we're talking about this indirection, and that's that we have extra overhead. So here, you know, sort of the overhead is, you know, is kind of zero because we have to allocate the whole inode anyways. We can't say I'm not using the direct block pointers in the inode. Well, we can say we're not using them, but we aren't actually saving space because we can't reuse them for something else. So in the case here, we actually have some overhead because we're allocating extra space. So for each indirect pointer, we're allocating a block of non-data, of metadata. So overhead, you know, that is space for metadata extra. And with double indirect pointers, we're going to do something similar, and we just recurse not up to the formula for direct pointers, but for indirect pointers. So space that can be pointed to is, well, we're going to say the number of double indirect pointers times the number of indirect pointers per block. And, well, because these are pointers to block, these pointers to blocks, they should take up the same number of space regardless of whether they're direct or indirect. So this is likely the same formula as we had before. So the double indirect pointers, again, are equivalent to this many indirect pointers, and that's times the space per indirect pointer. Since they're equivalent to that many indirect pointers, then the space each indirect pointer gives us, which we got from above. And we have the same for overhead. We get the same quantity one block, where, remember, one block was the, oh, sorry. So we have, so this is a little trickier. So for each double indirect pointer, we have the overhead from the indirect pointers it points to. So we have this times one block. So this is the, remember, one block was the overhead per indirect pointer. And we also have the overhead of storing the indirect pointers themselves. So this is the space for the indirect pointers. So it's these two quantities added together, plus the overhead of the indirect pointers themselves. The blocks of direct pointers they pointed to. And when we do triple indirect, it's similar. Again, we have this sort of recursive strategy because we have this tree structure. Now, so this is sort of the filled out version. And when you're talking about how much a file uses, something, so in a file, we don't have to have all the pointers be non-null, basically. So we're going to save space where we can have null pointers. So most notably, maybe I need a double indirect pointer, but it points to only a block of indirect pointers, and only the first two have anything in them, because my file is just a little too big to use the indirect pointers. So we'll save space that way, and you have to think about which pointers are null and which terms in these formulas do they correspond to if you want to figure out what the overhead is. Or you can try to draw it out, something like that. But so save space by not storing the extra pointers, and of course not storing data that isn't in the file. Yeah.
For all those overhead calculations that we went through, the number of pointers is the number of non-null pointers.
So the number of pointers that we care about here would be, when I say indirect pointers per block, you actually care, the number of non-indirect pointers. You want to compute, so this quantity, this whole thing in the brackets here is the number of, we're computing the number of indirect pointers. So what you actually care about for that is the number of non-null indirect pointers. Because you're not going to allocate that block. Yeah, so you should remember, if you don't memorize the formula, memorize what each term is supposed to represent. Because you should be able to both figure it out from what it represents, and that will tell you, is this null in this case? And doesn't that matter? Yeah, so the formulas I've given here are the worst case, but in practice you'll miss part of the tree, basically. That we could use all these pointers, but we won't. Other questions about trees? Okay. I guess the other thing that's notable about another overhead issue we talked about briefly is that we store, whole blocks or maybe fragments, even if the file is not a whole number of blocks, fragments, large. If we have a 10-byte file, we can't store 10 bytes randomly on disk. We have to store a whole block, or at least a whole fragment of the file. Okay. So then file system snapshots. So I guess there's two things we can talk about with file system snapshots. So there's two views. So one view is how it looks to the user. So the user point of view, is that we have two copies of the file system, or more, two or more copies of the file system, which represent different versions of the file system, but they save space when they have files in common, and backups take the form of make one of these copies.
So that's the user point of view.
And the implementation was copy on write. That if the two copies are exactly the same, they have exactly the same data. So if the two copies have one file that's different, then we're going to have indirection so we can support only changing that file. So they'll have, you know, pointers to different inode arrays, and only one inode will be different between the two. And to make that even more compact, inode will be different between the two, and the two inodes will have blocks in common where they share data. E.g., if one file was appended to, like the things that were before the append will be the same. The things after the append, the copy that has the append will have an inode which has extra block pointers where they point to the same block. Now, something here to different inode arrays. Well, there's a problem there that storing two copies of the inode array would be very expensive. So this is the straightforward copy and write strategy, but the problem is the inode array is often like 2 million inodes, and that's not something we want to copy every time we make one of these backups. We want them to be really fast and efficient, space efficient. So the inode array is going to be stored in pieces. And we'll have an array of pointers to those pieces, and only the parts which are different between the two copies will have different pointers. So the idea is that we have our inode array in these pieces, we have just a list of pointers to the pieces, and when we change this one file, we change one of those pointers for the place where the inode array changed. We change that inode to add the extra block pointers for the appended data in a copy. So we have two copies of that inode, one with extra block pointers, but we don't actually have extra copies of all the shared data, all the shared directories, and most of the shared inodes. Okay. And if more things are different, we have less shared data. So sort of the implementation, so things, you know, details that we need to handle are, you know, so normal file updates need to make the new copies, because basically what's going to happen is we're going to have a snapshot, which is the old version, and we're modifying the current version, and that current version now needs a new copy of something that's being modified. So we're going to do sort of our work of keeping our backup by when we actually do the new stuff. The other is we need to track reference counts. So we need to figure out all the cases to make sure that, well, it's not enough to say, is the block free or not? What I actually want to know is how many people are using the block. So when I delete a file in one snapshot, if it's still used in another, I don't free up its blocks and reuse them. So there needs to be some tracking, some sort of global tracking of what blocks are actually free, and also say what parts of the inode, what inode array segments are actually shared, because when I get rid of a snapshot, I want to make sure I only get rid of the parts of the snapshot that aren't shared. So we didn't talk about the details of how to do that, but you can imagine if it's reference counting, it's conceptually similar to what you did in paging protection. But probably the bookkeeping is a lot more annoying, especially if you want it to be fast. So is this what people were looking for about snapshots? Okay, then quiz today 1 and 2. So as I mentioned earlier, for question 2, I had it miskeyed originally because I miscounted the number of zeros. So good work there. But let's go over question 1. So the scenario in question 1, so was, the scenario was we had something using trap and emulate and a user program running in the guest operating system. So let's first remember our terms, just so we're clear about this, that we have our guest OS program, which runs on top of our guest OS, which runs on top of our hypervisor and host OS. This is the layering we have, and this is hypervisor and Hope OS is what actually can, you know, is most directly talking to the hardware. And we have a guest OS program, triggers, tries to access memory that it was not allocated, but will be allocated on demand by the guest OS. And we ask what will happen. And there are two options that were popular. So I'll start with the one which most people selected that I did not mark as correct and explain why I did not mark it as a correct answer. So this option was sort of a wrong answer, and this is a subtle. So we have the first part here. So first we had the user will trigger a page fault in the host operating system, and this is correct. It will do that. That page fault handler, so this is the, remember that, maybe I should have like used different words, that page fault handler is the host OS page fault handler, because I said in the host operating system a page fault, will update the guest operating system's page table. And this is sort of not correct, because the hypervisor doesn't update the guest page table itself. It doesn't know what the guest policy is. The hypervisor doesn't know that the memory is considered allocate on demand by the guest OS. All it knows is that there was a page fault and the guest OS needs to handle it. Because this is the guest OS's policy, not the hypervisor's policy. So, you know, guest OS policy, not hypervisor policy. This was another thing which maybe the question was, there was more information in the question than there maybe should have been. But you know, it says by the guest operating system. So the problem here is that we're not having the guest OS do the allocation on demand. We're having the hypervisor do it, and it doesn't actually know the right information to do that. All it's supposed to do is pretend to be like the hardware, and the hardware wouldn't know how to do that on behalf of the guest OS. Your question?
Yeah, so does the guest OS have an application version update its own page fault handler?
The question is, does the guest OS have its own page fault handler? Absolutely, yes. So the trap and emulate, so this will get us to the right answer. Oh, I see. I gave no right answers. Okay. I just need to drop that question. I gave the, so let's just casually rekey the, I'm just, that question is just wrong because there's no right answers. Well, 0 points and dropped meant to not say. So the problem with the second the first option was almost right, but then I decided to add an extra word for no reason. So I'll just drop this quiz question. And this would be right if I removed the words kernel mode and just said in user mode. So correct answer, so problem, hypervisor never runs the guest OS in kernel mode with trap and emulate, with normal trap and emulate. I guess maybe with hardware virtualization support, we might be able to do that. With hardware virtualization support. So there's kind of a possibility there where it was possible, but that was not my intention to like bring that up. So the correct answer would be this, but just like that would be like there. So that would be the correct answer. So we have to run the guest OS handler to do it, but yes, it doesn't run in kernel mode, so sorry, I inadvertently didn't leave a correct answer because I forgot I wrote that there. Yeah.
But then in that case, you're assuming that page fault handler is the guest operating system's page fault handler, not the host, right?
So the host operating system, yeah, so that page fault handler, the host OS page fault handler, yeah, so this is the, so the host OS page fault handler ends up delegating to the guest OS page fault handler is the idea. We talked about this as sort of reflecting the exception. Yeah.
Okay, and then so when the guest OS updates its page table, that could potentially leave the hypervisor to update the shadow page table then, right?
So the question is when the guest OS updates its page table, that will trigger the hypervisor to update the shadow page table? Yes, eventually at least. Assuming we're using shadow page tables and not like nested paging. But yeah, the key thing, and I'm disappointed I added that extra thing, because the like key thing I wanted to get across is that we need to delegate to the guest OS because our hypervisor just doesn't know that the memory is allocated on demand. And it's not gonna do that for us. Yes.
So this would need to be correct to interpret kernel mode as
So it would be correct if you interpreted kernel mode as that fake kernel mode, or when I mentioned hardware support for virtualization, I mentioned that you can run things in kernel mode, but you have the processor set up so it will exit to your hypervisor when certain events happen. So it's like pseudo, it's like kernel mode, but it's like less privileged than normal kernel mode. But yeah, that was not the intention of the question. That was just a mistake in the question. Okay. So the correct answer, which was not an option. So I will drop question one. Because I just should not have done that. So as for question two, which as I said, also miskeyed, but none of the above was the correct answer. So I just keyed that correctly, just because I can't count zeros. So here, question two was we had, so Q2 was we had a guest page table, containing, and the last level guest page table containing, PPN 40. And the question is, what does the shadow page table entry corresponding to this look like? So page table entry. So this is one entry, and there's one shadow page table entry corresponding to this. And we just need to figure out, so physical page number 40 is what machine page number, is what the question is really asking. The shadow page table entry corresponding to this, substitutes for the guest PTE in the, hardware
page table. So we need to take what the guest thinks. So, and I guess I should, just to review terminology here, I'm saying virtual to physical to machine is the terminology I'm using, like I talked about slides. So machine are real hardware addresses, physical are what the guest thinks are hardware addresses, and virtual are what the guest thinks are program addresses. And we were told that the guest memory, guest physical memory, is that and with six zeros, not some other number of zeros, like I thought when writing this question, keying the question. So it starts at this, which is the same as machine at, you know, machine address, which is the same as machine page number OX1000 because of 4K pages. Because when we split this up, so if we split this up, this is machine page number, machine page offset 0. Because we have a 12-bit page offset, which we knew because the question said 4K pages. And we were told that the hypervisor allocated the memory contiguously, which is, so that means that, so physical page 0 is 10, and if we add one page to every address, we get physical OX1 is machine page 101, and so on. Or alternately, you can think of this as physical address 1000 is machine address 1000. Those are equivalent when we do the splitting up into page offset and page number. Yeah.
In the description to that question, it says that physical address 0 corresponds to machine address. It has a mapping, but it seems different than what you're explaining now. Am I misunderstanding, or what does that explain?
So, I probably should not have put machine address in the guest OS because that is unnecessarily confusing. That was a mistake. But other than that, it just should be a machine address and not, say, in the guest OS. Yeah. That's me wanting to write in the guest OS too many times. I want to put it somewhere in the sentence. I just put it both places instead of one. I guess I don't need to consider whether I want to drop two parts of this quiz. Yeah.
So you truncate that first address because it's 4 kilobyte pages?
So I want to get it. So I have two options. So one option is I can translate page number to page number. The other option is I can translate byte address to byte address. So another way I could have done this problem is I could say physical page number 40 is physical addresses 2F. What machine page is that? I can work from this number. But I need to make sure I'm working with page numbers only or addresses only. I can't mix the two. Okay, other questions? Okay. I assume there are more things people want me to talk about. Okay. Any
other topic? I'll just collect a list of topics since I have enough time that I'll probably get few. Yeah. Question, are other OS designs going to be covered? We covered microkernels. That's about all we covered in any real detail. And we didn't cover microkernels in that much detail. Yeah.
Can we also talk about like the different file systems and when you would want to use one versus the other? Like,
yeah, pros and cons of file systems. OK.
Can we go over different page replacement policies?
Replacement policies. OK. Anything else? OK. So I'll do in this order. So communicating devices. So when I said, so a big difference that devices make is how does the device controller get fed data? Get data or send data to the OS. So the simplest option, simplest option is the processor sends the data on the memory bus, probably the memory bus, to the device. This means the OS needs to have code that explicitly copies to the device, copies to or from the device. Because the processor has to say, hey, device controller, give me this byte. Hey, device controller, give me this byte or this word. But it has to do that copy. And in this design, means the device controller probably has a buffer with a physical memory address. And the OS uses that. So we saw this with the keyboard. So the example was the keyboard controller. We just read from the current key press buffer. And that's how we read a key press. And if we think about disk controllers that work this way, we would copy from disk controller buffer into our page cache, which is what we do for reading a file, for example, or vice versa, to, from. So the problem with this is now we have to spend time copying the data when we could do other work. And it's going to be kind of slow because we're not using the cache to do the copy. We're just talking to the device. Another option is that the device is on the memory bus somehow, and stores or loads data from memory at a location the OS specifies. So this means for a disk controller, OS says my cache will be at this address. Load into it, for example. That's what the OS will send. So it makes it more efficient. So this is more efficient. So data device controller can use memory as its buffer. So no extra copy needs to happen. So like the device controller might avoid making a copy at all, an extra copy, and just as it's getting the data from the device, it can send it to that memory location. Copy needs to happen, put where OS wants as received from device. Like, it's not guaranteed, but that's the ideal scenario, is that we set this up, the device controller just writes to memory directly, and even internally, it doesn't need to make this extra copy and then copy to memory, that it's actually just using that as where it goes. And this is just more efficient. And it's also more efficient because the processor can be running other code while the copy happens. And in particular, as long as the code doesn't use memory too much, we'll run just as fast. If it uses memory a lot, there might be some contention because only so many things can write to memory at once. or read from memory at once, but as long as it doesn't use memory too much, it's going to run basically just as fast. So those were the two mechanisms. This is the programmed I/O option, and the other one was called direct memory access, or DMA. So the programmed I/O option, requires a buffer on the device controller. Because if the device controller wants to receive data, it can't rely on the OS reading it as it's getting it. So it needs to buffer that on its controller. It doesn't have another place, needs a place to put it. That's where it's going to need to put it. This is a better fit for something like a keyboard controller where how big can that buffer possibly need to be? With a keyboard controller, it's probably not worth setting up, here's a page of memory for you to write key presses. That's not worth it, since I'm going to need to communicate with the device anyways to figure out, do I have key presses and so on. So this sort of requires device controller to take memory addresses from the OS, and the device driver needs to allocate memory to the device. Yeah?
Would you say that you use program I/O to set up the DMA?
So question, would I say use program I/O to set up the DMA? I would not put up the category of the things you do to set up devices in general in either of these. I would just say that's part of doing the I/O. Because all of these, this still communicates with the device controller. Device controller to, set up memory addresses, figure out whether read or write happened yet, figure out if there's an error. So you still are going to talk to the device controller, but you're going to be getting that sort of metadata from it. You're not going to transfer the actual data that way. Yeah?
What's the difference between the device controller and the device driver?
The question is, what's the difference between the device controller and the device driver? Okay, so this is device controller, driver versus driver. So the device controller is the hardware that's attached to the processor, probably via some bus. The device driver is the part of the OS that knows how to communicate with the device controller. Yeah? The question is, how does the device driver trigger the interrupt? So the device controller is what can trigger interrupts. So it has whatever bus it's connected to is going to have some signal that can be sent on that bus where there's some hardware on the processor to turn that into an interrupt, basically. So there'll be an extra wire on the memory bus for cause interrupts to happen or something like that. I don't know the actual details, and I know it varies between different bus designs. And the device driver is what's going to respond to interrupts. So it's going to arrange to be called from the OS's equivalent of trap for the device. Yeah?
That's the bottom half of the driver?
Yeah, so respond to interrupts. We've called this the bottom half. I'm not going to quiz you on top half, bottom half, partly because some people use the opposite terminology. But yeah, that's one part of the device driver. Yeah. So the question is, what devices support these options? So programmed I/O, so this sort of doesn't make sense for keyboards, et cetera. So devices, which don't transfer much data. So things which don't transfer very much data at all probably aren't going to do direct memory access. I guess keyboards might be the wrong word, things that are only keyboards, like a USB driver probably supports direct memory access because you connect things like hard drives to your USB port, and we want it for that. But for like a keyboard, it doesn't make much sense just because there's not enough data to actually save any time. Like, you might as well read your key presses while you're checking, is there an error? And typically, my understanding is that device controllers support programmed I/O in addition if they support direct memory access, but maybe that's not, and I guess that's not always the case. So historically, programmed I/O was the old option. So like, disk controllers that want to be compatible with old stuff have to have programmed I/O. But I guess there's some times when you might not support programmed I/O. The most common case would be if you have the type of device where you want a big buffer and you just don't have the hardware for it on your device controller. And I think this happens like for some graphics card drivers. Like they just, some embedded graphics like work this way. They just don't have the memory. They need you to allocate memory to it to use it. So they only support DMA. Okay. So other questions on programmed I/O DMA? Okay. So page replacement policies. So the biggest family of page replacement policies we have, so the sort of main family, was least recently used and approximations. So we can't, you know, usually can't do exact least recently used, because that means that you'd have to update a data structure, you know, like a linked list, on every read and write to memory, which would be a lot. So you probably can't do that. You might be able to do it for like read and write system calls, but probably not for like read and writing memory. So approximations. So we had sort of simple approximations. So one approximation was the second chance policy, where the idea is, you know, so, and these approximations, I guess, were all based on this common concept we see in the second chance, which is approximations based on was it accessed since I last checked? So second chance, check if it was accessed since it got on the list. So this is, I guess we should say, keep an ordered list of pages. If yes, put back on list. No, this page is probably hasn't been accessed in a while. That was one policy we had. And we had sort of more sophisticated policies. So we had the seek policy, which was keep two ordered lists of pages. So we have the active, assume probably used, and the inactive, the guess possibly unused. You know, and check if, you know, move pages from active to inactive, check if it was accessed while on the inactive list, either when it gets, you know, perhaps check before it gets to the bottom. So I guess we had like two options for this. Was it accessed since I last checked, or mark as invalid temporarily, briefly, and see if it gets accessed. So those were our two options. And they produce similar results because you can approximate one by just checking, you can approximate responding to it being accessed by just checking frequently if it was accessed. So they're related to each other. So the seek idea was that we, you know, hope only scanning a smaller list of pages for accesses rather than, so can more quickly, don't assume a page accessed a long time ago isn't safe to event, which would happen with the second chance policy, because things spend less time on the inactive list. And also, if you're scanning the inactive list to do this, this is much more efficient. And that's something you might end up doing in some implementations. Were there any others? I think these were the big ones. And I guess we talked generally sort of clock, just general idea of periodically scan plus clear, was it accessed information. And do something with recent history for each page. So the seek policy is kind of a version of that. We're scanning a subset of the pages all the time and going through all the pages because we move things from active to inactive to check whether they're being used. So clock is the sort of general idea that you could do more and more. You could figure out how to interpret it was accessed the last 7 times I checked versus it was accessed 5 of the last 6 times or something like that. You could figure out various interpretations. But the key idea is that they're using either something gets marked as accessed or they mark it as invalid and see when it's accessed and respond to that. If accessed, move back to active list. If not, OK to reuse. Hasn't been accessed recently. And one way you can think about all these approximations is not recently used, right? That's the point of the approximation, is that we're not going to get the least recently used page, but we're going to get something which isn't recently used, and that's why it's okay. So the other, sort of the secondary family we had was, heuristics for cases where least recently used is wrong. So one we talked about is scanning files. We had this, Linux's heuristic was allow things to be evicted. They make it, evicted if they aren't accessed twice. And make it from top to bottom of the inactive list. So it was a modification of the seek policy, but the key idea is that they wanted to make sure things were accessed twice to deal with scans or singly accessed things. Yes?
But if you are scanning through a block, through a cache block, won't you access it multiple times within the scan because it's a whole block, it's a big data?
Yes, so question is, the question is, won't we access a page multiple times? Yeah, so the twice I didn't define precisely in lecture. So access twice needs to mean, with some interval in between. That I did not specify how you do that, and that is actually an important question. But yes, we aren't literally going to only load twice from the page, because if we want to read a whole page, we have to load multiple times because we don't have a 4K load instruction. Yeah?
So is that done by, so it's done with a time interval, not with just analyzing?
So I guess one way this can be done either with some interval in between or because it's done via read calls. So probably the most common case is it's done via read calls. And so for a read call, the read call probably is reading the whole page at once, and the OS can know that and keep track of it that way. If it's done the other way, we'd have to do interval in between. I don't know if Linux does that.
But it definitely can do the read calls version of it. Right, because with a read call, you know, oh, you're reading five pages with one call to read. I can count that as one access only. And that's definitely, almost certainly the most common case of this. Is that not that you mmap it, but that you just read. Do this loop calling read with like a, you know, multi-kilobyte buffer to process a file. Okay, other questions? But I guess for the time interval in between, I don't know if Linux does that, but I think Linux does that, and I think the way it does that is the way it detects the references is by scanning periodically for accesses. So the idea is that there's some interval in between the scans. So you probably won't be interpreted as accessing twice randomly from that, even though you do have multiple real accesses. At least on most OSs, it scans for that. Architectures. So other questions about page replacement policies? Yeah.
Do you have to know details about proactively freeing pages?
You should know, like, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to know a particular algorithm, but you should know, like, about proactively freeing or read ahead. You should know, like, why are those good ideas? What are, like, the sort of things, goals you have when doing that? What would be a reasonable, what would be some reasonable options for implementing it? That sort of thing. Other page replacement questions? Okay, so pros and cons of file systems. So I talked about a lot of file systems and didn't actually like do a good or bad directly, and this is mostly because there's not actually like super agreement about this. But generally I'd say, so the FAT file system, you know, it's relatively simple to implement. You might not believe that, but it's relatively simple to implement, especially since all the path traversal logic is something you need to implement for every file system. And typically OSs have one implementation of that that's shared among all the file systems. So everything else is directory reading, and so on. You know, there's not multiple cases because you just have the linked list structure, which is the same for every file. You don't like have to handle double and triple indirects in addition to that. So, you know, simple to implement, and, you know, probably practical to implement with a very constrained memory. I'm not, like, this is at least something I've heard. I'm not sure if it's actually true when you think about it, but like it seems maybe less bad than an inode-based file system for that because you like load a directory entry and then you can figure out where the FAT is and read it on demand. Yeah.
So that's because it has less overhead
and has less of an expectation that you're like keeping things cached than the sort of Unix designs. And like not reading, and like the reading a file was sort of a sequential operation, not a read the, I know, maybe, this is debatable, but because it's simpler, like it seems more amenable to like making a FAT implementation which only reads a sector at a time, for example, which is something you might want to do if you had a very constrained system. So, yeah, that's sort of pros. Sort of the FAT file system cons are seeking is very slow. Like, when you implemented, for those of you who implemented pread, like, getting to an offset was a sequential operation. You couldn't just skip to byte a million of a file. See, reliability is, there's no reliability features. If you're writing a FAT file system and you lose power, who knows what state it's in? Did you update the FAT or not? You know, so you can do some careful ordering, but like that's also bad for performance. So
So it doesn't help keep file and directory data close to each other. In particular, you know, always have fat pointers at beginning of disk. So if you want to update a file, you need to update the fat pointers and the file, which are probably at very different parts of the disk. For reading, this isn't so bad because in practice, on a desktop, you just load the whole fat into memory and keep it there. But if you want to actually update it on disk, well, you have to write to all sorts of places on the disk. No file system support for keeping file, directory entries close to the files they refer to, etc. Like, there's not any file system feature that will help with that. You could imagine doing, allocating your directories and such to help with that, but the file system doesn't store any data that will make that easy. So those are some cons. So then we had sort of other file system designs. So our sort of FFS-like file system has some features which sort of show us cons in fat. So one feature was shows cons in fat in like simpler inode-based file systems. So one feature was avoiding allocating whole blocks for small files, which we call fragments, which FAT didn't support. Another was block groups, which was keep file plus directory data close to each other, at least sometimes. Another possible sort of benefit was have all the free block information in one place in a more compact format. So maybe it's easier to scan for free blocks than on FAT, where you need to look at these 32-bit FAT entries. Here we have like 1 or 4 bit entries in the free map for each block. And we have some other FS features that are helpful. So we had extents. Sort of the pro was more efficient for large files. And the con was more complicated to allocate effectively than blocks, than single blocks, because if we want to have big contiguous blocks, we need a way of doing that now. And more complicated to seek through. If we have multiple of them. If you have one, it's simple. It's simpler. But if we have multiple, harder. What other features? We had trees for directories. So the pro is more efficient to find a particular file name in a directory. And the con is more complicated to update, scan, etc. Logging. So journaling/logging was, pro recovery from failures, and pro was faster writes because we could write things contiguously and not worry about order. And the con is, more complicated to implement. Con doesn't eliminate data loss because we can accidentally delete files, we can have part of the disk go bad. We need some other solutions for those problems. That's all I can think of, and I'm about out of time. So I think this is about the time I have. So before I finish, I'd like to mention I had that survey, and it would be great if the response rate was like greater than 50%. I want to use it to help arrange my next semester schedule and think about whether I want to make any big changes to homeworks or small changes to homeworks. That would be really helpful. Otherwise, thank you for a great semester, and see you in the exam next week or off.